Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Go online right now, and lots of websites will offer to tell you what your home is worth. But Home Sweet Home does not work like other investments.
Every day, you know what the clearing price is of a share of Apple stock or IBM stock. A home isn't nearly as liquid an asset.
And you can't bank on an appraisal from a website. We'll find out what you can do with it. Plus, Dave Ramsey has millions of followers, but his ideas have earned him a few enemies, too, namely credit card companies.
I reined them in years ago. I used a pair of scissors. If you chop up these things, you don't have a problem with these people.
We'll hear more from the Total Money Makeover Guy. And life in a disaster zone has some homeowners ready to risk it on their own.
After past performances by insurance companies, I don't think it's that much of a gamble. I've already spent my money and got nothing.
It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Next time you're driving around the neighborhood, count up 8 homes. If those 8 all have mortgages attached to them, at least one was either in arrears or foreclosure in the first quarter of the year. So much for glimmers of a housing recovery. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
I really don't want to spend the next few moments telling you about the latest rash of housing statistics. It's still a horror show. Enough said. So let's talk about dinner parties. You know, the ones where we used to jabber on about how much we paid for our homes and how much those online websites said they were now worth? Nah, but we talk about it anymore, is it? And yet, Zillow, Trulia, CyberHomes.com, they still get our eyeballs. We wondered what exactly they are good for. Let's put that question to Nick Ritsinas, director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Thanks for joining us again.
Nice to be with you.
What role do these appraisal websites play in kind of the overall housing market?
Well, they give people a sense of what the value of their home is. Lest we forget, for most people, their net worth is concentrated in their home. And people, of course, are concerned about seeing an erosion in the value of their home, which they see as the principal part of their net worth.
And that really is the opposite of what we were all using it for 3 or 4 years ago, which is to watch how our home values were going up and up and up, right?
In the past, it really was used to try to give some substance to bragging rights.
Right.
Gee, look how much my home has appreciated in value. Look how much richer I am, how much richer I feel. Unlike the stock market, where every day you know what the clearing price is of a share of Apple stock or IBM stock. A home isn't nearly as liquid an asset, and this is really a way to overcome that illiquidity.
I really have to question how they come up with these numbers, because I went on a couple of websites and looked at my own home. There was a $300,000 difference between what CyberHomes.com said my home was worth and what Zillow said it was worth. Do I just need to stop looking at this? What is really the point of these websites
well,
anyway?
You have to ask yourself why you're looking at it, because until you're actually ready to sell your home, it really has no value until you find a willing buyer.
Well, that's true. And let me tell you why I was. It's because, you know, we were thinking about refinancing and I wanted to get some idea of what my home might be worth before I paid for an appraisal. But this really doesn't tell me anything.
It will give you an idea. The problem is it'll give you a variety of ideas. All of these websites use data from sales in the general area where your home is. Some of them will apply sort of rates of general market appreciation. Some of them will factor in information about the economy. The models are not particularly transparent, so it's hard to say specifically what they look at, but they do not take into account whether your home is a better home, better kept, or worse kept than your neighbor's home.
I guess mine just shocked me. $300,000, I could buy another home for that difference.
I mean, we have these websites in other sectors too. The so-called Blue Book, in terms of value of a used car, gives you some sense of what your used car is worth, but it doesn't say that's the price you'll get if you bring it to a dealer. It doesn't say that's the price you'll get if you sell it to a neighbor. It is an approximation. I think the real irony of all these sites is this obsession and this focus on the home as a financial asset and purely a financial asset. And now, in a sense, we're paying the price for that.
So what do you think the popularity of these sites says about the way we do think about property?
People are trying to translate the macro information that they read and listen to every day about what's happening in the economy, what's happening in the house market. And they want to ask that question, well, what about me? What about my home? But it can influence behavior. For example, if you looked at these sites and your home was worth a lot more than you thought it might have been from listening to the headlines, you might say, well, I guess I'm a little richer than I thought I was. I guess I can be a little freer with my spending than I thought I could be, or vice versa. And it's the behavior, particularly the consumer behavior, that ultimately undergirds our economy.
Nick Ritsinas is the director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
What about you? We want to know what these home appraisal websites say about your house. Go to marketplace.org and look for the link that says, "What does the internet say your home is worth?"
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. American Public Media presents The Next American Dream. What will it look like? Find out more at nextamericandream.org.
We've heard from lots of you about how banks are cutting your credit lines, everything from credit cards to home equity loans. And it's happening at every income level, even to Sterling Bank customers. Stacey Vanek Smith has the story of one couple who got caught in their bank's catch-all credit net.
It's a perfect evening in the Southern California beach town of Encinitas. Surfers bob in the waves, pelicans fly in formation, couples gather on a high bluff to watch the sunset. Ava Sturgeon and Jeff Stevenson come here every night.
Oh, the sunset's going to be early tonight because there's a marine layer.
And we'll see. One of the things we've learned living here is that you can't predict a sunset the way you sort of think you can.
And these days, the same goes for your financial future. Avis and Jeff had a healthy savings, a fat portfolio, a strong 401k, and they sold their house at the top of the market. That put them so far ahead that in 2007, Jeff quit his job at Microsoft and the couple traveled for a year. Then the market collapsed.
You know, you've been saving for 15 years and it's gone. How could we have imagined that we would have lost half our money in 6 months?
Almost immediately, though, Jeff, who's in his late 50s, got a good job near Encinitas. And with some scaling back, he and Avis, she's in her early 50s, were able to buy a house. To help smooth the transition, Jeff and Avis tapped about $20,000 from a $100,000 credit line they had with Wells Fargo. They'd had the line for 10 years and rarely used it. Then the letter came.
Okay, so this is the letter that we got from Wells Fargo, and it says they're discontinuing the line of credit and that starting in November, we have to pay it back at 2% of the outstanding balance for 50 months plus interest.
Translation. Wells Fargo canceled Jeff and Avis's credit line and required them to pay back the $20,000 within 4 years. That means Avis and Jeff will see their monthly payments jump from less than $50 to several hundred, plus interest and fees. And here's the really weird part. Just 4 days before they got that letter, Wells Fargo had given Avis and Jeff a big mortgage loan, a loan they could no longer afford.
So doing something like this, just, boy.
To say, we're going to give you a mortgage and then in 5 months we're going to make it impossible for you to pay that mortgage is beyond belief. And what kind of a business model is that?
The business model of a panicked industry, says Robert Manning, founder of the Responsible Debt Relief Program. He says almost $1 trillion in credit will disappear over the next year and a half as banks shut down unsecured lines of credit and credit cards. And Manning says high earners are getting hit too.
Today, everybody's at risk of losing their jobs. Higher income households owe more money, and now the banks are concerned a high income household's account, they would lose 2, 3, 4 times as much as a middle income account.
Banks are trying to cut credit and shed risk so fast that one part of the bank, like the mortgage part, doesn't always know what another part of the bank is doing, says NYU economist Lawrence White.
Banks are rediscovering that it's a risky world, and I'm sure there's been some overreaction. It's hard to not have an overreaction after what we've gone through.
Wells Fargo told Marketplace it didn't single out Avis and Jeff. It discontinued their type of credit line entirely. Wells Fargo also said only a small percentage of its clients were affected. But Avis says the bank's actions have put her and her husband in financial distress. And now their lives will have to change if they want to keep their house.
How is it going to change?
We're still trying to figure that one out, actually. Yeah.
I mean, this is such a shock. You know, we felt that we'd already made the changes. Let's see, how often do we eat out? Once every couple of months? Jeff takes his lunch to work every single day. We don't have a fancy car, anything like that.
Ava says now she needs to get a job if she can find one, and she and Jeff will have to drain their savings, or what's left of it, to pay off their mortgage and credit line loans. In Encinitas, California, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So you taking a vacation this summer?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No question about it.
Yeah, me too. But I really hope you're going to take your work with you. Because otherwise, you just don't know what's going to happen back home.
Now, are you trying to suggest something about my personality or my
habits
here?
No, I want to talk about this Challenger Gray and Christmas thing that came out this week where they basically warned people, you better not take a vacation, or if you do, you better be hooked into the office because otherwise you might lose your job.
Right, my favorite part of it.
Jeez!
The wellness experts that have this utopian vision that you should, you know, break away from the office and get away. But in today's world, you can't do that. I think this is nuts.
Anything at all, that if you go on vacation, you're more likely to lose your job?
Look, there are a couple things that are going on. First of all, everyone is scared. But we all know that Americans don't take enough vacation as it is. So my feeling is this sort of tough love message, you know, we're going to give it to you straight, I think is a mistake. And there is not any business that I am aware of that does not recognize that there is a genuine value toward the employee getting away.
Where do you think this fear stems from? Because, it, you know, it wasn't only kind of the advice from the Challenger folks, but they did do a survey that said 35% of workers said they're not going to take a vacation this year. 71% say they can't afford it. Close to 1 in 5 say they're afraid to lose their jobs.
I think it's human nature. But I think you just sort of have to do a couple of things. First of all, I don't want to minimize. There may be a workplace where, you know what, maybe you better not take a vacation because something's going to come down pretty soon. Okay, so let's just say that. But okay, for most people, you go away on vacation, talk to one of your colleagues and say, look, I'm shutting off the computer. But if something really important happens,
call me.
Here's the number.
Yeah.
Give me a call. But only in an emergency or only if something really important. That's fine. Go ahead and do that. But what I really am concerned about at this time, it's so natural to sort of retreat. We don't want to take risks. We don't want to stand out. And these are just the wrong things to take from a time like this. And in fact, you have to actively counteract them.
So the best way to do that, I would think, would be to take a vacation?
Take a vacation.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks.
How many of us complain about our credit card company or our mortgage company or our student loan company? Well, personal finance guru Dave Ramsey, he doesn't want to hear about it.
If a company's not a blessing to you, quit doing business with them.
He'll give us details of his debt-free regimen next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. I'm going to say a name right now, and then I'm going to sit back and wait for the swoon. Ready? Dave Ramsey.
Thanks for calling in and doing this. You ready to scream I'm debt-free?
Yes, sir. We sure are. They're very excited.
All right, Shannon. You count it off for them.
Okay.
Let's hear it. All right.
I'm debt-free! Yeah!
One, two, three.
We're debt-free!
I mean, what other radio host would let you go on the air and yell at the top of your lungs that you are debt-free? Rush? Probably not. Susie? Nah. Me? I'll think about it. Meanwhile, we invited Dave to join us because A, lots of you listen to him and us, and B, credit and debt are his passion, and we wanted to get his perspective on the mess that we all find ourselves in. Dave Ramsey of the Total Money Makeover and the Dave Ramsey Show, welcome to the Marketplace Money Show.
Well, I'm honored to be with you, Tess. Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to start with a news item from last week because it's right up your alley, and this is the credit card reform bill. Now, this has been hailed as a really big step in personal finance, reining in some of the industry's most egregious practices. But based on what I've read in your book and heard you say on the air, this is no giant leap for all of us.
Well, I reined them in years ago. I used a pair of scissors. If you chop up these things, you don't have a problem with these people. I'm sorry. It's great that universal default is gone. It's great that we're trying to get companies that misbehave to behave. But, you know, there's the other side of the coin, and that's the consumer has to take responsibility. And that's, you know, if a company's not a blessing to you, quit doing business with them.
Yeah, you know, I think I read that you haven't used a credit card in, what, 20 years or so?
Thereabouts.
What's that like? Because I don't know.
Well, I use a debit card. I can do anything that you can do. I just can't go in debt.
You know, your big message to all of us is that the only real way to have stability and to build wealth is to get rid of debt, although you do make an exception for mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of us in personal finance talk about, say, the differences between good debt and bad debt. Credit cards, bad. Student loans, good. You want us all, the entire nation, to never use debt, that none of it is good. Why is there no such thing as good debt?
Well, it's really simple. I've looked at people that built wealth. By and large, they stay away from debt. They don't discuss good debt. Only financial planners discuss good debt. And as a matter of fact, when the Forbes 400, the wealthiest 400 people in America, were surveyed, 75% of them said the best way to build wealth is get out of debt and stay out of debt.
I want to ask you about your views on credit scores. I think you've called the FICO score an I love debt score. Is that right?
Mathematically, that would be accurate, yeah.
We talk on this show, and we're certainly not alone, about the necessity of a credit score so you can get a mortgage, and insurance companies use the score, employers pull credit reports. How do you function in this particular banking society without one?
The FICO people tell us that 35% of the accumulation of your FICO score is based on your debt history. 30% is based on your level of debt, 15% is based on the length of time you've been in debt, 10% is based on new debt, and 10% is based on types of debt. I can hand you $10 million cash, and it will not change your FICO score one penny. It's not an I'm winning at life score. It's a I've been kissing the bank's butt on a regular basis score.
As an average consumer who is not a multimillionaire, when you promote this notion that you shouldn't worry about your FICO score, isn't that really hard for a lot of other people who can't otherwise function?
Well, I certainly didn't start out a multimillionaire. It's pretty easy to function without one, honestly. It's just that you're not running around trying to borrow money all the time. Now, if you're going to borrow money all the time, then you need to worship at the altar of the great FICO. But if you're not worried about borrowing money all the time, then the FICO score is really not a big deal.
Let's talk about your debt snowball. This is part of your get out of debt program, and you encourage people to pay off the smallest debts first and go from there. Whereas on other personal finance shows, this one included, we talk about paying down the debt with the highest interest rate first. What makes your plan better?
Well, to start with, anyone who gets somebody out of debt, I'm in agreement with. The thing that we've discovered is this: personal finance is about 80% behavior. Once we understand that my problem is the guy in my mirror, if I can control him, he can be skinny and rich, then I start to understand that, gosh, personal finance is about relationships. Now, when we take that and answer the question, then we would say, gosh, if I pay off the smallest debt, I feel like I got traction. It's kind of like going on a diet and losing weight the first week. If you go on a diet and you don't lose weight for 3 months,
oh, you're
going to
quit.
You quit going to the Y. I mean, bagels, here we come, you know? And so, you know, but if I pay off two or three little debts, I get excited. And by the time they get to their largest debt, they've got so much emotional momentum that they can plow right through a $15,000 or a $20,000 student loan or a $15,000 or $20,000 car debt and not even look back. Is it mathematically correct? The weird thing is, Tess, we've done case studies on these. It's only about 1 or 2 months difference. The difference is people keep doing it.
Your books are really full, and your airwaves, of all kinds of success stories. Does anyone ever write in having tried the system and it just didn't work despite what they really think was very true commitment?
No.
Okay, moving on.
I'm not saying they're not out there, but I just don't get that letter. I guess they think I would probably challenge them on their commitment because I would. Now, are there times that someone calls me and they agree and I agree because of something going on in their life right now? We're going to push pause on that. You know, it works when people are able to work it, but not everybody's able to work it at this moment in time in their lives. You know, a guy called me today on my show, and he just got laid off. And he said, well, you know, what do I do about paying off my debt? You don't right now. You eat. You take the severance package, and you set it aside as a huge emergency fund. Because, dude, you are square in the middle of an emergency. But now when you get back to work, that severance package becomes a signing bonus, and let's accelerate your total money makeover then.
Dave Ramsey is author of The Total Money Makeover and also the host of The Dave Ramsey Show. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Tess, it was an honor to be with you.
And in fact, we enjoyed our chat with him so much, we're bringing you more of it next week.
The selling of debt as an absolute necessity to live is really one of the most masterful marketing jobs in the history of the world.
And he says we're all paying a stupid tax because of it.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show when we answer your questions. And I'm here with Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's go right to the phones. We have Laura on the line in Chicago, Illinois. How are you, Laura?
Good. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What can we do for you today?
Well, I just started my first business. And so while I, you know, get it up and running, I need to carry a balance on my credit card for the first time ever. So being you know, a diligent listener of your show, I called the bank to try and negotiate a lower interest rate. And they said that they were already offering me the lowest rate they could, but that I could write a convenience check to myself for a lower rate. It just seemed kind of shady to me, and so I wanted to know if that was a good option.
I'll just tell you, those convenience checks that they send, I just want to say right now, I wish that the credit card companies would stop sending them because, boy, talk about a perfect outlet for identity theft, fraud.
There's all kinds of problems
associated
with them. And also, convenience checks in the end are a very expensive form of credit.
Right.
The rate is typically somewhere between 20, 25%. So, you know, as a general rule, I mean, Tess, you've already answered this part of the question. I just would agree, echo Tess's comments that most of the time, convenience checks are not a good way to go.
Okay.
Chris, what kind of options might you have with the SBA?
Well, there's a couple of thoughts I have. Now, do you have a business plan that you prepared and that you can take to a banker?
Not yet. I'm embarrassed to say that.
What is the business?
It's an online bookstore that sells bilingual children's books.
Oh, okay.
So I started it more for the experience, but then I fell in love with it, and I realized that there is a strong demand for these books, and so that's when I decided to take it full-time.
Okay, so here's the Chris Farrell during a recession, how to start a small business plan.
Okay.
And there are two elements to it. The first is to come up with a business plan. And there's a lot of resources at the Small Business Administration online. Just going to your library, there are services like Encore, which are retired executives all around the country. They'll help you, you know, come up with a business plan.
Okay.
And then go to credit union, community banker, bankers that will tend to loan to a small business in the community. And what they're going to do is go, ha! You want a loan?
They're going to laugh at you?
You want a loan? Nice. They won't actually laugh at you. They won't be that rude. Then you say to them, okay, well, what do you think of my business plan? What would it take for you to lend? And you go away and you rewrite your business plan and you come back. And you say, now, well, how about lending me some money? They'll go, no, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, they're getting to know you. And they're seeing you adapt your business plan. They see that you are dedicated. So that after a year, year and a half, you know, all of a sudden they might go, you know, I really admire what you're doing. So maybe we will lend you a little bit of money.
But Chris, it sounds like we're really saying try to stay away from funding your small business with credit card debt.
As much as possible, because really what you're trying to do is build up a business. You don't want the pressure of those interest payments. And if it succeeds, then I hope it does. You are giving up some of the upside, but it will probably succeed, or one of the elements that will, if you have equity financing as opposed to debt financing.
So, Laura, do you think that you can maybe wait a few months, year, year and a half, as Chris was saying, to convince a bank that you're a good risk?
I think so. I hope so. Of course, you know, there's always the idea, too, of holding down a part-time job, at least to pay the bills and while I get this started.
That's right.
You bet.
All the classic stuff that all entrepreneurs do. I mean, they're basically hustling to get money from all different kinds of sources to fund their dream.
Right.
Well, good luck and let us know how it goes.
Exciting.
Thank you very much. I will.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And next we have an email from Warren in Kernersville, North Carolina. Chris, he says he has a Roth IRA. Yay.
Okay.
And he contributes 10% of his salary to his company 401k.
All right.
All of his investments are only available through a full service investment company. So he's thinking about moving them, some of them, to where he can control the cost more and maybe take on a little more risk by using an online investment service. And he wants to know how he goes about doing this.
All right. So what you do is you pick your online investment service. You do a little bit of research. Some are more geared toward people who trade a lot.
Right.
Others, you know, they really reward the buy and hold investor. And then you say, okay, I'm opening an account here. I want to transfer my Roth IRA, because that's really what we're talking about, because the 401k.
No choice there,
and you continue to contribute. So I want to transfer my Roth IRA. What's your process? What's your procedure? And it's basically a rollover and there's no issue. And of course, there will be hiccups because the company that has your money, they really would prefer that you not leave. But the bottom line is it's done all the time. It's not that hard. But focus on finding the right online service for yourself.
Okay. And Chris, we've been getting quite a few emails from folks wondering about Social Security and the stimulus package and how and when they're going to get their $250 check. Now, my understanding was most of these checks should be out by now.
They should be out by now because they started mailing them in May. It was done in batches.
Uh-huh.
What the Social Security Administration said, and it's on its website, if you are a Social Security recipient or an SSI recipient, you should be getting your check. But if you haven't gotten the check by June 4th, then get in touch with them.
All right. Well, if you want to unload some of your financial questions, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can write to us. We are at the Getting Personal link on marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. A lot of us are trying to figure out how to live differently these days. For some, the change has been forced by a layoff or losses in a retirement fund. For others, it's a matter of finally starting to live within your means. But today we hear about a family that's voluntarily stepping off a financial cliff. Here's Kathy Duchamp.
Meet the Pham family of South Baltimore, Lou and Christina, both 38, and their baby girl.
This is Katien, 7.5 months old.
She's the main attraction for us.
Yeah. Yep, the new center of the universe.
That new center of the universe is pulling the Pham's in a direction most parents today don't think they can go. Lou Pham is about to put his biostatistics career on hold to take care of Katien. Christina will continue to work full-time as a director in the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. The Pham's income will be cut nearly in half to just under $80,000 a year.
I feel like Hooray! We're doing what we want to do. We're not making excuses for why we can't do what we want to do.
What the Fahms want to do is spend more time with their daughter and less time chasing a second paycheck. They didn't think it was possible at first. Like most professional working couples, the Fahms were shopping for daycare. But then they ran the numbers and realized it wouldn't cost that much more to give up one job and stay at home with the baby. But it would take something else to put their plan into action. Practice.
We've been living as if we're on one income since early February.
The Fahms have been budgeting and making adjustments. They changed their health care plan to get more affordable coverage. They knocked 10% off their monthly mortgage payments by refinancing, a move they made while they still had two incomes and looked good to bankers. Not only do they have a plan B if the stay-at-home dad thing bombs, they have a plan C. It includes going back to work.
By nature, I look at risks as something that you can manage, not as something unknown. I try to bring measurement into the whole process.
Now, at this point, I'm starting to think Lou and Christina are not like the rest of us. For one thing, they chose to give up a paycheck rather than have a job disappear. Even so, I realize there's a lot we can learn from them after talking with University of Wisconsin professor J. Michael Collins. He studies how people make financial decisions.
People tend to get pretty anxious when they think about making financial decisions. And it's not unusual for people to get so anxious that they almost become stuck.
Collins says denial tends to kick in at the point where we really need to be paying attention. He saw that firsthand in a focus group of people who had defaulted on their mortgages.
Many of them talked about putting all their mail in their couch or sticking all their mail into the kitchen drawer without opening it. Because they were so nervous about what might be in that letter that they just stopped paying attention to all mail, which, of course, it did nothing to help their situation. In fact, it made their situation worse.
The Fahms may never come to that, but like lots of people in today's economy, they've battled credit card debt for years.
I had credit card debt, and it wasn't a pretty sight.
Yeah, paying for the dinners that I had in college, you know, 10 years later or whatever. Yeah, that's kind of the way it was.
I mean, you really have to make a choice to take responsibility for it and then actually do it. And there's no other way.
The Fahms chose to take responsibility when they decided to buy a house. They got a Finance for Couples workbook and actually did the exercises, learning how to take the emotion out of money decisions.
You know, that heightened sense of anxiety and fear, we just dropped those levels down, and it's something we can talk about rationally.
One thing they still do, 4 years and one child later, a weekly budget meeting.
Instead of, you know, when someone's busy washing dishes and the other has a screaming child in their arms saying, what happened to that payment for the insurance company? Instead of asking at that time, we know to come to our meeting, bring whatever issues you have so we don't ambush each other.
Baby Katien will probably be at those meetings as soon as she learns to walk. Parents Lou and Christina hope the frugal living lessons stick, at least for a while.
Maybe she'll rebel by being a really big shopper.
Yeah, you never know.
Lou Fahm starts his new life as a stay-at-home dad July 1st. In Baltimore, I'm Kathy Ducham for Marketplace Money.
A notebook and a pen may be the best tools in personal finance when you use them to track every penny you spend.
There's nothing more powerful than seeing your spending habits staring back at you in black and white.
We'll check in with one of our listeners as she stares at 30 days of spending and tells us what she sees. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
We'll be right back.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tessa Vigeland. You've no doubt heard about people who go without car insurance. And, of course, millions go without health insurance. Now some homeowners are facing a similar choice. Ever since Hurricane Katrina in 2005, the cost of insuring against a disaster has spiraled as fast as the winds themselves. The next hurricane season starts Monday. From Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretz reports on how some people are coping.
Rather than going broke, some homeowners in hurricane-prone areas are going bare.
Going bare means going without insurance.
That's Robert Hartwig with the Insurance Information Institute. He says about 4% of homeowners go bare. Nationwide, that's about 3 million people. Charles Fetton is one of them. Since 1965, he has lived in a modest two-story house in Pompano Beach on the Atlantic coast of Florida. He has an American flag on the lawn and wind chimes by the front door. Fetton is a retired auto mechanic on Social Security. In 2005, his insurance premium quadrupled to $500 a month, half his monthly nut. So he dropped his windstorm coverage.
Basically, I couldn't afford it. I'd have to borrow money to live.
Fetton was able to drop his hurricane insurance because he's paid off his mortgage. Banks require people with home loans to take out insurance, so going bare isn't an option for most homeowners. Some retirees have resorted to selling their homes and moving in with family. Others have moved out of state. Fetton crunched the numbers. His home suffered $35,000 in damage from Hurricane Wilma in 2005, but his insurance company paid only $12,500. Much of the damage has gone unrepaired. So Fetton decided to drop his insurance, in essence, to bet his house against Mother Nature.
That's why people gamble. You win, you lose. But after past performances by insurance company, I don't think it's that much of a gamble. I've already spent my money and got nothing.
Experts say that going bare is a dangerous idea for all but the wealthiest people. Robert Hartwig.
Looking to save a few hundred dollars where you could lose a few hundred thousand is simply not a way that you should view the investment in your home, which for most people is their most valuable asset.
Going bare is a national phenomenon, but it's most acute in hurricane zones like Florida, where premiums have gone up the most. Ed Domansky is with the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation.
Florida, by its geography alone, is simply an inherently risky state. I mean, we are a panhandle. We are surrounded by ocean and Gulf, and we are not a very wide state.
Alex Soto is an insurance agent in Miami. He says more of his clients are asking him about going bare. Soto tells his clients that insurance isn't just about economics. It's about peace of mind.
I have somebody who has all the means to do it, and they said, I won't be able to sleep. The hurricane season is June 1 to November 30th. I cannot go without sleeping that long.
Going bare can shift the burden of rebuilding to the federal government. People who don't have insurance are often eligible for grants from FEMA and low-interest loans from the SBA. William Stander is with the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America.
If you're relying on the federal government to come rescue you because you're not carrying insurance, all you have to do is take a look at Katrina and how long it's taken for some people to get help.
So what other options do you have to lower your monthly insurance premiums? You can increase your deductible, the amount you pay out of pocket before insurance steps in. You can shop around for another insurance company that offers lower rates. Or Stander says you can also lower premiums by hardening your house.
Whether it's by adding hurricane shutters, improving your roof-to-wall connections, putting in impact-resistant windows and doors, there's a lot of information available from FLASH, which is the Federal Alliance for Safe Homes.
One Coral Gables man took this idea a step further. He built a house made of solid concrete, the foundation, the roof, even the interior walls. Officials dubbed it the bunker and judged it could withstand a Category 5 storm. Then the man dropped his insurance. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
We're back with more Getting Personal, and our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here with me. So let's get going, Chris, shall we?
Oh, absolutely. Love the questions.
All right. Well, first we have Niles on the phone in Sulphur Well, Kentucky. Hi, Niles.
Hi. How we doing?
We're doing well. And you?
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Excellent. Well, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I have a home in the neighborhood that I believe is going to be going up for foreclosure, or it is going up for foreclosure. It's just starting the foreclosure proceedings.
Okay.
And I was wondering, should I start inquiring about trying to purchase this home now, or should I let it get into the system and go that route?
Thinking of buying the foreclosure.
Yeah.
I would definitely pursue the pre-foreclosure. And it seems to me you can create a win-win situation for the current homeowner that's going to lose the home and for the lender. And if it doesn't work, well, then it goes into foreclosure, and then you can always put a bid in auction, right?
Niles, do you know these people?
Yes, I do.
And is this something that they're open to? I mean, I would think maybe buying a house of a neighbor's that is in foreclosure might be a little awkward.
A little bit, but it's an understanding that if I can help them out, I'll do it. And if I can obtain the home, I'll do that too.
Yeah, so contact the owner and you're going to make a bid. When you're buying a home in pre-foreclosure, you're sort of looking about 20% below market value.
Okay, good.
Or another way of looking at it is, and this is, again, this is a national figure, Tess, you might have seen it, but it costs a bank about $50,000 to put a home into foreclosure.
Right.
So you're really saving them a lot of money, a lot of time. This potentially creates a win-win situation, really, for everybody, because the homeowner's going to avoid going into foreclosure. You're getting a home at a good price, and the bank, they're free and clear of this property.
Chris, is this basically a short sale?
It's not really a short sale. There are some elements that are reminiscent, but no, this is a real sale coming in, and basically you're getting it for a cheap price.
Well, Niles, does that help you out?
I think that helped me out a lot.
Terrific.
All right, thank you. Have a good day.
You bet. Bye-bye. All right, Chris, and we have an email from Brandon in Chicago, Illinois. He got his degree in 2008. He has a steady job, maxes out his 401k. He's slowly paying off his student loans. He saves a little each month.
I love him.
This sounds great.
Okay, so what's the problem?
Well, he's thinking about going to business school in a couple of years. Should he focus on paying down these current student loans before he starts looking at taking on some new ones?
My feeling is that we're in a world where, you know what, having less debt is good.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a good idea to have as little debt as possible going into that situation. That just gives you more flexibility. And by the way, let's think about something different. When you graduate, you've gone to get this MBA to open up your horizons. But if you have a lot of debt, you're going to take the first job that comes along that's going to help you meet those debt payments.
Not necessarily what you really want to do.
Exactly.
Well, then what should he be doing now? I mean, as we said, he's kind of trying to take care of all these various savings vehicles. Should all of it be going to the student loan?
No, I wouldn't do that. And here's why. There's one thing you can't bring back: time. So he goes to get an MBA in 3, 4, 5 years. He's 3 to 4 or 5 years older. The other thing is, what if he changes his mind? So I continue to participate in the 401k plan. You're going to continue to want to have some savings. So really what we're talking about is putting an extra bit toward the student loan. You know, I would just sort of do things more at the margin rather than take dramatic action.
All right. The Chris Farrell plan versus the Dave Ramsey plan.
This is true.
All right. Well, that's all we've got in terms of time for Getting Personal this week, but you can give us a call anytime. That number is 877-275-6669, 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or write to us. You can do that through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And that's also where you will find Chris's blog, where he's got all kinds of answers for you on all kinds of issues. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Well, we just heard about dealing with your student loan. Can't just make it disappear with a sleight of hand. But on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we'll meet someone who practices a form of abracadabra every day.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Glenn Gary, and welcome to Parlor Magic.
I'm Gary Flesher. I'm a professional full-time magician.
I've been on stage since I was probably 5 or 6 as an actor, singing, dancing. The magic bug did not bite me until I was 15 and I saw a professional magician. After the show, I went up to him and asked him, how did you get started? How did you learn this? And he gave me the address for Abbott's Magic Manufacturing Company. I spent 1 week's salary from the theater and ordered just a bunch of magic apparatus. When it came in, my mother saw it, and she said, well, if you can spend a whole week's salary for this junk, you don't need my support. All magicians have to start out with amateur shows. And we do the little birthday parties and the family gatherings and the shows for the friends. And hopefully we grow. I haven't been nervous for years, except the first time that I played the Magic Castle. Though the Magic Castle is in Hollywood, it's the place in the world for a magician to perform. I was in the green room, and all of a sudden I hear the announcer saying, put your hands together for Mr. Glenn Gary. I got the worst case of butterflies. My hands were visibly trembling. I had to stop. I just looked out at the audience. I said, I'm sorry, you will have to excuse me. Would you care if I just started all over again? Magic and magicians are a fraternity, but we're also competitive when it comes to marketing and getting shows. My show here at the Westin Hotel, I do a show every Wednesday and Saturday night, and it's my responsibility to fill the room. This is a business, and we're here to make money. In this economic times, of course, people are watching their dollars, and now I'm getting more and more people calling up saying, how much is this show? Oh, it's that much. Well, thank you. We'll have to attend another time. There's some magicians making $1 million. I'm not one of them. $100,000 is a good salary for today's magician. I'm going to give 4 people in the audience the opportunity to select 1 envelope. It's not the trick. It's not the magic. It's how you make it entertaining to your audience.
That was magician Gary Flesher. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. We've been talking to listener Gail George every week since the beginning of the month as she conducts a little life experiment for all of us. She's been tracking her spending to find out where all the money really goes. So it's time for a final check-in. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Doing well. And here to help us out as well, we are joined by Gail Cunningham of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. She spent years helping people create these kinds of family budgets. Hello, Gail number 2.
Hi, Tess. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Well, Gail George, let's start with you. You've got a month's worth of tracking under your belt now, so tell us what you think it did for you.
Well, I think it gave me insights into just how much I'm spending in a variety of areas that I guess I hadn't really thought about before. I mean, I was paying things, but it just hadn't dawned on me just how much all those things add up to.
Yeah, you know, I remember at the beginning you were pretty sure that most of your money was going toward groceries. Did that end up being the case?
No, I would say transportation, all sorts of car-related expenses and insurance and licensing and fuel and maintenance and all those things. Actually, my car ended up, even though it's paid for, the car ended up costing, I guess that fuel price going up is really making a difference to all of us.
And what else did you find that you were surprised by?
Medical. Because as a teacher, our medical is paid for. However, the out-of-pocket expenses are pretty high for things that are either not covered or that have co-pays and things like that. And that's quite a big chunk monthly as well.
Now, Gail Cunningham, let me turn to you. You have reviewed some of Gail George's efforts. Want to give her a grade?
Oh, dear. She is a school teacher, isn't she? She's used to handing out the grades. Well, I'm going to give her A+ for agreeing to do this.
Because there's
nothing more powerful than seeing your spending habits staring back at you in black and white. And I know that I've listened to all of your previous interviews, and Gail started out doing this on paper. You know, I don't care if people do it on a Big Chief tablet. Just the process of doing it creates such an awareness in people that translates into changing their spending patterns.
Well, so what does she do now with all this information that she's gathered? What's the next step?
Well, I think that she sits down and evaluates if that's how she chooses to spend her money. You know, we work really hard for our money, and she can decide for herself if she's happy with how this turns out. Or if those surprises that she mentions, if there's any latitude, any flexibility in those spending categories that she could move some money around, make some smarter choices. I noticed a couple of things. What about savings, Gail?
Yes, Tess and I had talked a little bit about that I want to try and put away 4 to 6 months worth of spending. I have a couple of things that I'm paying off right now, and I want to finish paying those off, and then I'm going to create a savings category, and thank you for mentioning that.
Excellent technique, because, for instance, when people pay off their car, I tell them, keep making that car payment, just make it to yourself. And I know that traditionally we hear that people like me, we suggest having 3 to 6 months income socked away. That is being ratcheted up to 8 to 12 months. And this is the first time I've said this publicly for the very reason, very response I got from you all, which would be the groan factor. You know,
that was both of us, by the way, Gail George, who groaned. So
I know it. It was in stereo. And Gail, what I would suggest to you is start socking away 10% of each take home, each paycheck, toward that emergency fund, which should sustain you.
Okay.
Gail George, do you think that's possible given your budget?
I do. 10% is something I would like to try and get from my budget anyway.
What were you planning to do with this once you were finished? You know, you've got all this information now. How are you going to use it?
Well, this first budget that I've done now, I call this the unenlightened budget. This is the budget that was just, it was a truth, but I put it in and it doesn't balance. And I said, okay, now that you know the categories that are high, I'm going to start to tweak some of those categories and bring them more in line. So, there are definitely some categories that I can work on.
Gail Cunningham of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, thanks for joining us for this this final effort here.
Loved it. And hats off to Gail George.
And hats off definitely to Gail George. Gail, thanks for doing this in such a public way. I think it's probably helped a lot of our listeners.
Well, that's great. I know it certainly helped me, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Tess.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next week, more people are getting cut to part-time status, and oh, what a difference that makes.
You know, 30 hours a week may not qualify for health care coverage and pension coverage.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Trobe. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.